From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've all heard about it, colony collapse disorder, disappearing bees, and the threat that poses to nature and to all the food they pollinate. But a story that big, we can't just note and drop. We're catching up today with what's going on with the great bee die-off, how they will live or die, how we will eat. This hour on Point, the fate of bees. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Beekeepers, have you seen the die-off in your hives, farmers, in your fields? What's going on? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. In a moment, we'll get the science, but we start with a film journey through the world of bees. Hear from the new documentary, More Than Honey, The Sound of Bees Buzzing in the Hills of Switzerland. It's a film that goes global in its look at what's going on with bees. Marcus Imhoff joins me now from New York, writer and director of the new documentary, More Than Honey. He's traveled across continents to record the crisis of bees. Marcus Imhoff, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Let's take us straight from your documentary to one of the sadder moments in the film, and there are many in addition to very, very beautiful scenes here. But here's a moment where John Miller in California, beekeeper, owner of a migratory bee company, discovers that he has just lost another hive to colony collapse disorder. He's opening the hive, and here's what he sees. We hear.
Okay, there's very few bees here. This is trouble. So let's have a look. There are no bees. This is what we don't like. Classic colony collapse disorder. A queen, 20 friends, and nothing else.
A scene there from Marcus Imhoff's new documentary, More Than Honey. Marcus Imhoff joins us from New York. Mr. Imhoff, you begin in the mountains of Switzerland, and everything is beautiful, and the bees look healthy, and you take us on a trip around the world, including to China, where they are now pollinating, collecting pollen themselves, and pollinating blossoms one by one by human hand. That looks absolutely unsustainable, Mr. Imhoff.
If we would do it here, an apple would cost more than a Swiss watch. But you can see how much the bees do for our daily life, for our food. A third of everything we are eating wouldn't exist without honeybees or other insects as well. So, and about 80% of all the plants wouldn't be there, so it would be quite a black and white world around us.
You've taken your camera into extraordinary scenes inside some of these hives and to the enormous almond orchards of California where the bees have historically gone to work. The bees that the United States agriculture relies on primarily were imported or came from Europe originally. How are those bees doing in Europe compared to how they're doing in the United States now?
The bees are dying all over in the whole all world. In Australia, they are the healthiest because there is this varroa mite doesn't exist yet there. But in Europe, in China, in Northern America, you have to give medicines to the bees that they can survive. They can't survive without any human help. And this is just dramatic. There are 30% or sometimes even until 70% of the bees every year dying. And if it goes on like this, they are replaced, but then the genetic pool is very poor and we will have a problem soon.
We saw the news last month that the estimates are that one-third of the U.S. honeybee colonies died last winter. Pretty unsustainable. People wonder about pesticides, fungicides, parasites, viruses, even malnutrition. We'll hear about that. But with, as you say, one in three of every bites of food consumed in the U.S. Directly or indirectly pollinated by bees, this is a pretty big deal. Your cameras have gone to China as well. And I wish you'd describe for us what you saw there. Here's the sound of a woman you interviewed there. This is Zhang Zhousu. She's explaining this process where, because of an absence of bees, she and her fellow, her colleagues, go out. They collect pollen by hand. They end up in trees, in orchards, painting that pollen into the little blossoms. Here is the sound from China, from Marcus Imhoff's documentary, More Than Honey.
然后去了以后,得住一个场地,非常大的场地,非常大的场地,好有亮化,
Again, this is Zhang Zhousu describing, she says, they travel far, they get to the south, they rent a big room, they dry flowers. When they get the flowers, they start processing them. That is, humans, by hand, pulling the pollen out of flowers, work that bees would have done. We take the pollen, she says, in a refrigerator, in the car with us on the way back north, connect it, keep the power on just as long as they can, keep it cool, do that to try and preserve the fertility of the pollen. Marcus Imhoff, what did you see? What did your cameras capture in China?
It's just a utopic view of what could happen if the bees really disappear. And it's the future in the present you can see there. And of course, you can afford it in China because the labor costs not so much like in Europe or in America. But you can see what the bees are doing for free for us. And it's worth estimating this and finding out what we could do for them.
You talked with beekeepers in Switzerland, with one in particular, for whom this is a multi-generational undertaking. Father and grandfather had done it before him. What did he tell you about how the work and life of a beekeeper and his bees is changing?
This Swiss mountain beekeeper, he tries to keep his black original bees from the mountains, and he is very... he tried that his queen are not mating with bees with the yellow bottom, and he ends up that his bees are dying as well because the inbreeding makes them weak. And for over 100 and 150 years, beekeepers are trying to breed gentle and industrious bees. But being gentle doesn't help the bees. If they are just gentle, they are not defending themselves against diseases as well. So we must accept that the bees have a stinger, and we should try to breed healthy bees, and maybe they make a little bit less honey, and you have to wear a bee suit working with them. But you have also to respect them more if they are more aggressive, but it's a normal thing for bees that they defend the honey.
Interesting. In the U.S., you almost always show beekeepers in bee suits. In Switzerland, very often without, smoking a cigar maybe to keep them at a distance, but very comfortable, very intimate with the bees. But even there, that really sad scenes of broods that have gone bad and died, being burned in a pit, trying to also do away with whatever killed them. And then you take your cameras on the road in the United States, where we have trucks that take bees all over the country to do the pollination work that's so important. But them struggling to keep those bees healthy and alive. Here's another little bit from Marcus Imhoff's new documentary, More Than Honey. Migratory beekeeper on the road with their big trucks, explaining how they transport enormous numbers of hives of bees.
We try to transport the bees in 2 days and spend one night on the road. The less time the bees spend on the truck, the better and the healthier they'll be. The bees can't fly outside their hives when we're trucking them to like go to the bathroom. So the longer they have to stay in their box and hold their potty, the more unhealthy they'll be. And it's stressful, and it's not natural for the bees to be on a truck. So the sooner we get them off the truck, the better it's going to be.
There from Marcus Imhoff's More Than Honey documentary, bees traveling across this country by day and by night. What's your sense of where this problem is most acute, Marcus? Europe, the U.S.? If China's the worst, what after that?
It's all over. Of course, in the United States, this very large agriculture industrial attitude is not good for the bees. The monoculture are not good because the bees are eating for 4 weeks only the bitter almond nectar, and then they are transported over thousands of miles to a next monoculture. And normally, paradise was thought in another way, that the bees can eat different things, not just hamburger for 4 weeks and then sausage for the next 4 weeks. It's just not healthy. And if you would not transport the bees, they would starve because there is nothing else in bloom. They wouldn't find anything to eat. So you have to transport them. But it's just from one industry to the next industry.
When it works, it's good business and good for all the agricultural production that it supports. When it doesn't, it's terrible. Here's a moment when one of the beekeepers you featured, John Miller, or a migratory bee company owner, is feeling good about the economic value of his bees.
Now, can you hear that? That's the sound of money. Fresh printed money. Bees and trees. Nice.
But very often in this documentary, that is not the sound of anything good. It's the sound of a diminished population of bees. Marcus Imhoff joins us, writer and director of the big new documentary, More Than Honey. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rolling catastrophe of bee die-off, colony collapse, and more. Looking at the latest on why it happens and how far it has gone. This bee sound and soundtrack behind me there, score from the new documentary More Than Honey. Its screenwriter and director Marcus Imhoff joins us. Here once more from the documentary, John Miller, beekeeper, owner of a migratory bee company, looking at hives he's opening up where almost everything is dead. And this is something he says he's sadly getting used to.
This is a total loss. And we don't know why. Just gone. Plenty of pollen. Plenty of nectar. No evidence of brood. I'm getting real comfortable with death on an epic scale. I don't like it.
From Marcus Imhoff's More Than Honey, the solution may lie in part with Africanized bees, but we also know them as killer bees, and they do that. Just this week, on Monday, a Texas man, Larry Goodwin, died after being stung by Africanized killer bees. Here's ABC.
A swarm of Africanized bees claimed the life of a Central Texas man over the weekend. 62-year-old Larry Goodwin was clearing off his land when he disturbed a beehive with his tractor. There were as many as 40,000 bees in the hive, and the killer bees attacked and stung Goodwin more than 3,000 times.
That risk may be part of our future as this thing rolls on. Marcus Imhoff joins us from New York with us right now from Davis, California's Eric Musson. He's one of the country's leading bee experts, or as more formally known, apiculturist. He's with the University of California, Davis. Eric Musson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for the invitation to join you, Tom.
What's the latest on the numbers and the trend line, Eric?
Do you mean on bees across the country?
Yes, sir.
It seems like we can't get ourselves out of this situation where on the average across the country, about 30%, 35% of the colonies die sometime during the season, frequently kind of late in the season, annually.
How long can that go on and still keep our crops pollinated?
I don't think it can go on a whole lot longer because there are a number of individuals who have had to start over again and again. That's very expensive. And the colonies don't build up fast enough that they can really generate much income. Many of the larger operations have seen this problem too, and so what's happening is they're shrinking. Their numbers of colonies are shrinking. They're still in business; they still have quite a few, but they can't get back to that original number of colonies.
We're looking at this matrix of potential reasons: pesticides, fungicides, parasites, viruses, malnutrition. What's your latest and best reading on what's going on, Eric?
I believe that you've hit most of the topics. Combine all those together, and the bees just aren't making it. If you could take any one of them, like if we could get rid of the mites somehow, if we could feed the bees better, if we could limit the toxins into which they become exposed, if we could do any of that, it would probably make things a lot better. But we're sort of stuck in a world out there where all those things are part now of commercial beekeeping life.
And fighting with all that seems it may be part of the problem. There's a scene from Marcus's documentary, More Than Honey. We're in an enormous almond operation in California, and they are spraying pesticides here during the days out of a truck, great big pesticide machine at work. And here's John Miller, who we heard before, worrying about it as he sees where his bees are going to be flying here from More Than Honey.
If they'll just not spray the bees, that's great. You know, ideally, they'd spray at night. When the bees are in, by the time the material is dried and isn't so lethal, it's the next day, if they'd just spray it at night. But, you know, you can't see at night. They don't know where they are. These fields are massive. They get lost. So they're going to do what they're going to do.
Eric Musson, if pesticides are dangerous, why are we using them?
Generally speaking, the different pesticides are used to mitigate, as it's called, a pest problem of some sort. And the sprays that go on during bloom in almonds, when the bees are in the field collecting their food and what contaminates their food, normally is a fungicide, which if it rains just a little bit and the spores of the fungus get down into the flowers, it just completely eliminates the ability of those flowers to produce a nut on the tree. So you go from having a potentially very nice crop to having practically no nuts at all.
But you've got to have the bees to make it all work. And here's John Miller again from More Than Honey saying once you get the fungicide involved, you've got problems for the bees.
It doesn't kill the bees, but it repels the bees. If after this material has dried on the bloom, the bees bring that material back to the colony and feed it to the babies, 19 days later, we see an impact on the brood. We see brood die off. And it's the fungicide at work. And pretty much everybody knows it.
Is it that clear to you, Eric Musson? It's the fungicide at work and brood die off.
Well, that's what we thought for a while, but then we found out once we did some analysis on the pollen that was out in the field that the growers have changed their practices some, and they've added an insect growth regulator, which is a kind of a fungicide that prevents the larvae from developing all the way through to adults against the peach twig borer larvae that happened to be out beginning to chew on the flowers at the same time. So now the fungicide's mixed with an insecticide, and they're both put in the field at one time.
Marcus Imhoff, I don't know if Eric has seen your documentary. Could you describe for us, Marcus, exactly how in the fields, orchards you were in China, exactly how did the Chinese get the pollen to the blossoms, Marcus?
In China, in some regions, they are acting as bees. They are traveling south to collect the pollen and then to work to dry the pollen and put it in the refrigerator that they are fertile, still fertile, and then they bring them back. And the people, mostly women, are climbing the trees and from flower to flower they are putting the pollen on the flower. It's about the sex of the plants. The over millions of years, plants and insects have created a cooperation that the plants can have babies only with the help of insects, because they are on the ground. They can't embrace each other, so they need a messenger of love bringing the sperms, and that's what the bees are doing.
Marcus has these images of lots of people climbing in the trees with little brushes, just daubing the pollen into the blossoms. I mean, can you imagine us getting to the situation in this country where we'd have to try something like that? Can you imagine it ever beginning to work on the scale of agriculture here?
Well, that wouldn't sound very reasonable when you have close to 800,000 acres of almond trees out there now that need to be pollinated. I can't imagine what kind of an army it would take, two or three armies, to even have enough people out there to do it. But actually, there's a little bit of the similar sort of thing going on here, because when our earliest varieties come into bloom, there's no compatible pollen. So we actually cut some branches off of trees of compatible pollen, force the pollen to come out a little early, collect it, but then instead of using a paintbrush or a feather to put it on the plants to get it where we want to, we dump it at the entrance of the hive. And when the bees fly out, they get it on their bodies, and then they go through the trees and pollinate the trees. So we're getting cross-pollination, even though there's only one variety in bloom. So some of these techniques are a little bit similar, but fortunately, we don't have to intervene with humans.
When the bees take off and we find an empty hive, what's happening there? It's kind of a mystery, even in the film. But Eric, what, are they just dying in the fields? Are they moving somewhere else? What's happening?
Apparently, they just fly until they're exhausted, drop, and that's the end of it, because we've never been able to find any suggestion that they got into a clump somewhere that we call a cluster. We don't see them. We don't see them going somewhere else and joining together again. They just fly out away from the hive and go until they stop going.
And they're gone. We've got lots of callers for you, Eric Musson, and you, Marcus Imhoff. Please stand by. Ernie's calling from Carlisle, Massachusetts. Ernie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm glad that you're taking my call.
Sure.
I've been a beekeeper for nearly 40 years, and I have experienced really bad problems only in the last 6 years, which I attribute in my mind to the new pesticides that have come in, the systemic pesticides, the neonicotinoids, and we have a lot of that in our town, and a lot of beekeepers in our town have had similar problems. And I guess what I'm really concerned about is why the U.S. government is so unresponsive, because many beekeepers have been complaining about the pesticides for quite some time. And you would think that a proper response would be to set up an area in a state or in a region where it would be pesticide free, and make a demonstration, give it 5 years and show that. I would be convinced that if you eliminate the pesticide part of this whole equation, the bees are going to bounce back.
Let us pick it up, Ernie, and I appreciate your call. Eric, take us into the latest thinking on pesticides, what we thought would work, what isn't working, what the EU does versus what the U.S. does. What have you learned, Eric?
Well, I think one of the first things we have to keep in mind is that any of those chemicals out there that end in C-I-D-E, side, means that they're meant to kill something.
Yep.
And actually, depending on, with the exception of like bacteria and fungi, they're a little bit different from us. Anything that's supposed to target an insect in particular to kill it is going to be hard on bees. And we're talking about, their physiology and their chemistry. And a target pest is awfully close to a honeybee, so it's really hard to find something that will hurt the target pest and not the bees. When they first brought these newer systemic materials onto the market, it sounded like it was a great thing, because you could limit your applications to maybe one shot on the plant, or put it around the seed when the seed was planted, or pump a little of it into the ground around the bottom of the root system of the plant, and you wouldn't be contaminating the whole environment. You'd just basically have it on that plant.
Yep.
But it tends, if it's all over the inside the plant like that kills sucking and chewing insects, it also tends to get into the nectar and pollen. And so under those circumstances, anything that comes along that happens to eat nectar and pollen could get into trouble. And bees are just one thing, because there's a bunch of beetles, ladybird beetles. We think of ladybugs as something that eat only aphids. Well, that's not true. They eat pollen and nectar too. So do a whole bunch of other predators and parasites that we consider good guy insects.
Okay.
So there's kind of a substantial amount of contamination out there. And generally, if you talk to the company, they will tell you their data that they got from use with applications in agricultural use. And that's the amounts that come back, the chemical that comes back in nectar and pollen, and those are pretty darn low. But when you start doing landscape use, when you start doing trunk injections on trees, mm-hmm. you can drive the amount of material into the plants way, way up compared to what's happening in the ag fields. And I think that's what's happening in many places where they say, there's no ag around here, but they're pumping imidacloprid into maple trees to try to prevent the Japanese beetle from defoliating the trees. And maples are one of the first thing that the bees, especially in the eastern part of the United States, get into as an early food.
And whether it's on the leaf or in the tree, they're collecting that food and with it collecting that chemical, and off they go.
Okay, they are collecting pollen from the maple, and the maple doesn't have a flower, as you and I recognize it, but indeed it does have a flower. It has a little thing that hangs down, and it has pollen on it, and maple pollen is one of the first things that the honeybees get into.
And the bees get it right there. Aaron in Nashville, Tennessee. Aaron, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, maybe just a quick story for maybe the hope of the bees, but my dad went out to his garage the other day and was met with a swarm of bees. He called his local beekeepers. They came in, they picked the hive away, and they're maybe hopeful that it was maybe a little more resilient bee to what's going on in the environment. So I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, Aaron, I appreciate your call. Eric, there's a lot of talk about this, but often that more resilient bee is this Africanized bee, which we also call the killer bee. We ran the tape earlier in the show of just this last weekend in Texas of a man killed in Texas by 2,000-3,000 stings, and he's dead. Is that the answer to our problem, Eric? These much more aggressive Africanized bees coming up from the south?
No, I really don't hope that that's an answer to much of anybody's question. You've got that problem with way too much defensive behavior from those bees. There's no doubt about it. And they're surviving okay now, but we haven't really trucked them into heavy-duty agriculture where you go to pollination after pollination and all that sort of thing because they're not fit to deal with. But even if they were, we've never really put them into the stress situation that we've got out there now in our European honeybees. And I have a feeling that although they can tolerate diseases better, they can tolerate the mites a little bit better, they can tolerate a lot of things a little bit better. When you come right down to it, if you start finding many ag residues in the combs and in the stored food, as well as the chemicals, well, we might not have to use the chemicals against the mites so much anymore because those bees apparently can somehow or another deal with the mites better. But nonetheless, those are not bees that we would ever purposely or hopefully have to use because you can't put them in the field and then go anywhere near them.
Mark Azimov, you found people who are using them already, who are desperate for bees, and they're using the Africanized killer bees.
You have to treat them more carefully, of course. You can't make backyard beekeeping. You have to keep them a little bit far away. Brazil, where they come from, is became the fourth most important honey production country in the world. But you have to change the attitude towards the bees, and you can't just it's a kind of revenge, if you want, that they want you to treat them better. And I think it's just for that we think about it, how we use nature. It's an interesting sign.
European bee colonies, disturb them. You may be stung 12 times, 20 times, maybe 200 if the whole colony pours out. Africanized bees, if they sense a threat, the victim can be stung 2,000 times. Kidney failure can come. Nobody wants to go down that road, but some are already, as European honeybee populations are suffering. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rolling catastrophe of bee die-off and the latest on why it happens and how far it's gone. Eric Musson is with us. He's a leading bee expert out of the University of California, Davis. Joins us today from Davis, California. And from New York, Marcus Imhoff is here, director, screenwriter of the documentary More Than Honey. You can see a trailer of that quite beautiful and disturbing film at our website, onpointradio.org. Just won the Prix Wallo Award, most important in Swiss show business for best film production. He's writer and director of many films, Fires in Paradise, The Mountain, The Boat is Full, Academy Award nominee. He's taken his cameras all over Europe, all over the United States, into China, where they're now painting pollen on by hand because the bees are just gone. And in this country, he found beekeepers looking to adopt the much more aggressive, sometimes deadly, Africanized or killer bees after years of dealing with the trouble that has hit the more docile European cousins. From his documentary More Than Honey, here's American beekeeper Fred Terry saying the aggressive, Africanized bees will survive.
They're completely wild creatures. They have not been domesticated. They are as they have always been. And people were very frightened of that. And then when I went to Brazil in 1995, I found that the country had completely embraced the African bee. That what we had been told about the African bees, that they didn't make honey, that they were not good pollinators, they were impossible to manage, I found that all of those things were completely false. They can survive on very scarce resources. If I were a gambling person, I would bet on the survival of the African bees over just about any other species.
They're from More Than Honey. Marcus Imhoff, how will it, would it change the way we interact with bees if we end up having to go to this Africanized bee?
We couldn't have this industrialized agriculture we have. It would have to be much more closer to paradise, our gardens, our way of agriculture. You know, a lot of people say we have to feed the world. That's why we need these monocultures. But the United Nations Food Report says we can guarantee this only producing more locally for the local people in smaller operations. But it's our attitude to nature. We have to ask ourselves, are we humans part of nature? And then we know a lot of answers. If you are not dictators of nature, but part of nature, and then it's like an orchestra and you are playing maybe the first violin, but you have to very carefully listen to a trumpet or the cello.
But that has not been the picture in much of what you're depicting here. I mean, Eric, could we hybridize? Could we tame these Africanized bees with time and effort so that they would become less aggressive, less defensive, less likely to hurt, kill?
Well, as the caller mentioned, there are individuals in the United States, particularly the ones that are in Arizona and some of them in Texas, who do keep bees that they're pretty sure are Africanized because that's about all it can survive. The European bees don't compete too well in Africanized bee territory. They're brought over here for almond pollination. Then they're turned around and taken right back home again. And under the circumstances, as far as I am aware, they might do like one more pollination somewhere out there in Arizona or whatever. But they're not trucked, you know, from one pollination to the next pollination to the next pollination like we do it here. And we have people that have to get into the field to do irrigation work. We have people that like to go out and monitor what's going on in the crops. And you just can't trust Africanized bees. Some days they're every bit as easy to deal with, you know, as our bees are. But the next day, they may be completely different, and that's when you get these really serious stinging problems developing. So I don't see, if we can have enough European bees to keep things going, I don't see a whole bunch of bees switching, beekeepers switching over to keeping Africanized bees. They're just not something that are easy to deal with, and they are a kind of a traveling liability if you take them and put them somewhere near domestic animals and people.
Could we interbreed them with more domesticated bees so that they would become less aggressive over generations?
Well, I guess I got two parts of an answer. In the 40 years that they've been down there in Brazil, the worst of the worst have been eliminated because they showed their true colors and somebody killed them. And so under those circumstances, most days, you can go out there and work your Africanized bees, sometimes even in shorts and a T-shirt, which is what we can do with a lot of our bees almost all year.
Yeah.
But if they start and the bees get a little pecky, as we call it, sometimes means some of them start to sting, they just shut down the operation for the day and go somewhere else. But I'm not going to give you all the details. It would take too long. But all I can tell you is the traits of defensive behavior are so dominant in the Africanized stock that you can have multiple times of you don't need it. 50% or more Africanized drones mating with one of our queens gives you full-blown Africanized behavior. If you turn it around the other way and take one of the African queens and mate with all of our drones, you still get Africanized behavior. You take her daughter, you can run that four generations with all European drones, every time, and you still got a bee that's hotter than anyone wants to handle. So that gives you some idea of how dominant those genes are, which means you don't wash them out very easily. And they tend to kind of keep to themselves. You'll find that the Africanized bees around here in California, and we got a lot of them down in Southern California, mm-hmm. are still pretty much Africanized bees. They haven't been outbred and outcrossed by European drones very much.
There's a moment in the documentary, it's really interesting, but here Fred Terry again, talking with Marcus Imhoff from More Than Honey, talks about trying, about putting a milder queen in an Africanized with a bunch of bees there to see if she might settle them down. Well, you'll see what happens to her. Here you go, from More Than Honey.
The bees were much more ferocious than any I had ever seen previously. I wasn't sure exactly what they were, but I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll find the queens and I'll put in nice new queens because these bees are just too mean.
Around the neck, huh?
And so I put in a gentle queen, and the bees killed her, and they raised their own queen.
Hard to change the behavior of the Africanized bees. Rob is calling from Lafayette, Louisiana. Rob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have really more of an observation, and I've been a beekeeper for 25 years, and I've noticed the colony collapse disorder, and I've also spoken with other beekeepers who seem to think that it possibly could be not one cause, but a group of causes. One being genetically altered crops, such as corn. The pollen is different. The pollen gets ingested by the bee, and it is foreign, so it's treated. I mean, I would imagine it's like an infection almost, that the bodies don't know how to deal with it. And then you add that on to the top of chemical pesticides and miticides and all the medications, they just can't take it. It's built up. It gets to a point to where they can't metabolize it. It can't get out of their system, and they're gone. It looks like they're being used for a purpose that is foreign to their usual purpose. They're trucked all over the country. They catch diseases, they get other things from other regions and bring them back to another region. It doesn't agree.
Yeah.
It just turns into a mess.
Pushed beyond their limits. I mean, one way or another, that has to be true here, Rob. I appreciate your call. Eric, what about genetically altered crops here? Corn and corn pollen is a potential problem. Have people looked at that?
Yes, but the only studies I'm familiar with, they added the pollen, you know, into the bee food and that they were feeding the bees and whatnot, and tried to check what it did, and they couldn't see anything specific. You have to remember that the chemical alterations in the plant, let's say it's Roundup Ready corn, mm-hmm. all that did was add an enzyme. There's an extra enzyme in the plant tissue to break down that Roundup molecule when it shows up. when you go out to the pollen, you're going to get the genetic material. Pollen is alive. It has to be to grow the cells to make a seed. Mm-hmm. You're going to get the genetic material, but no one thinks that a little tiny piece of DNA seems to be much of a problem for bees. And you're going to get a little bit of the, perhaps, of the enzyme that breaks down Roundup. Well, an enzyme is just a protein, and when it gets into the intestinal tract of a bee, the chances are it just gets digested like any other protein. So I don't think the pollen itself is a problem. We're running into problems with not with corn pollen per se, but with situations where the bees are put out in an area to perhaps make some honey or to perhaps pollinate a crop, and there's corn nearby. Corn pollen is attractive to bees, and they go to it. But the thing is, it isn't very nutritious. So if they're collecting a whole lot of corn pollen, and maybe, if they're lucky, one more, they're really, really short on pollen. Like Marcus said, they need a smorgasbord of food out there to eat. They need a whole bunch of pollens in order to meet their nutritional needs. And in many cases, they're only getting one or two or something like that. And so nutritionally, they're going down. And as soon as their nutrition is down, then their health is down, their immune system is down, their detoxification system is down, everything is down. And your last caller hit it right on the head. When too many things get down, the bees go down.
Sounds like we and bees may be in the same boat on that. Amy writes to us, she says she's wondering how much climate change could have to do with die-off. What about that front, Eric?
Well, we know from past experience that honeybees can go way up into northern Canada and survive fine, and they can take it right down to the equator, and they get lazy down there, but they still survive. That doesn't seem to be a problem. So temperature isn't going to really bother the bees one way or the other. It could impact the food that they're eating, but then again, they're generalists. They'll eat practically anything. So I think under the circumstances, they'll probably be able to handle that without much of any problem at all.
European bees were brought over, and they have become the mainstay of pollination on this continent. What about native bees? The native bees that were here before the European bees came, could they reemerge as an answer to this crisis, Eric?
The native bees are still here, but the problem that we have is abundance. First of all, they're nowhere near as abundant as they used to be, because every time we put in any kind of human changed habitat, we normally fix it so that they don't have any place to live anymore, or we take away their food so they can't eat anymore. So we haven't got anywhere near the numbers that we used to have when this was a, we'll call it a wild country, mm-hmm. or something like that. There are a few of them that show some potential of being pretty darn good pollinators. There's no doubt about that. But again, it's a matter of numbers, because, you know, just imagine 800,000 acres of almonds with two colonies per acre. You know, and those colonies probably have, well, 16,000 to 20,000 bees in them. So you multiply that out, and the numbers are astronomical. Well, it's very, very hard to try to build up a native bee population to get there. And then the second thing is, once you're done with the honeybees, you can take them away, and then you can go into these pest control programs. If you're relying on native bees and they're going to hang around there, because if you start moving their domiciles, as we call them, mm-hmm. When they're still working out there and whatnot, even if you take it overnight and bring them somewhere else, they kind of get lost and you don't get back afterwards, so they're not very good to be moved. Well, now you got them stuck out there during the time that the person really wants to start pest control. So yeah, it's going to be a little touchy, but I think some of them are going to be very good at either complementing or supplementing the honeybees. The best part is, when you get one of those native bees out there, it pokes the honeybee and makes the honeybee, instead of just staying right on the pollen line and another one staying right on the nectar line and not really accomplishing much pollination except when they mm-hmm. rub together in the hive, mm-hmm. it makes the honeybees bounce all over the place. And so they are much more efficient pollinators if a few of these native bees are vexing them.
Mix it up and vex them, and you may have a positive outcome. Pilar in Virginia yep. Beach, Virginia. Pilar, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've seen more gardens than ever. I go on my walks in the neighborhood, and it seems like maybe one in every 10 houses has their own little garden.
Great.
And I'm wondering if, Eric, if it would help for individuals to learn how to have their own hive and also plant different species, whether it's, you know, trees and or fruits, vegetables, particular flowers. You know, something like that with people who do, they want to have their own gardens. I've noticed that I keep saying to people next door to me, where are the honeybees? I haven't seen hardly any, and not even any bumblebees. What I am seeing a lot of are wasps.
Pilar, let us look while we have time. Eric, what can individuals do that might help the bee population? Are there steps they can take?
Well, she's absolutely correct. I mean, the two things that can be done are you can plant flowers that are known to be bee attractive, so you'd have to look that up somewhere, in staggered plantings, especially so that they get some food in August and September. That's a really low spot for a lot of our bees. And then the second thing is you got to be really cautious about, if you're going to run a garden, if you use pesticides, which one you use and when you use them, that sort of thing.
What's the answer? What's going to happen here, Eric? Are we going to run out of bees? If we're not, how are we going to turn it around?
Well, I've been in this business for 37 years now, and I've come to the conclusion that, you know, the bees are going to be still on the earth. Whether or not we can use them the same way, I don't really know. But they made it through the dinosaurs, and they made it through the glaciers. And so it's pretty certain that they're going to make it through this, too. But whether or not we can still use them as we're using them, that remains an interesting question.
That's a pretty big question. When they pollinate, if it is one in every three bites of food we consume, what happens if they're not up to that task, Eric?
The amount of food that we start producing goes down and the prices go up, or we start importing from other parts of the world where things are working a little better. And it is interesting that this CCD phenomenon seems to be a northern latitude problem.
Colony collapse.
It's a north thing. South of the equator, there's a little, but not very much of it at all. But north of the equator, we're seeing it a lot.
Marcus, what's your projection, your prediction? Who survives better, bees or humans in that case?
The bees will survive, as Eric said, because they have survived other catastrophes. I don't know about us, but maybe we have to try to adopt what's going on Earth.
Well, that puts it in very sobering terms for both species, I guess. Marcus Imhoff, this is a really beautiful piece of work and important piece of work. I thank you for making it, and I thank you for joining us. The documentary is More Than Honey. Marcus, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me invited. Thank you.
And Eric Musson at the University of California, Davis, thank you for your work. Stay on it, Eric. Thanks for being with us today.
You bet.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Me at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks to all of our staff for all their work here every day. Tomorrow in this hour, snob zones and residential zoning. Join us for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.